of over 800 Americans, entrepreneurs and employed adults were asked to choose which of the following three ventures they would prefer to start. A. One that made $5 million in profit with a 20% chance of success. B. One that made $2 million in profit with a 50% chance of success. C. One that made $1.25 million in profit with an 80% chance of success. The entrepreneurs were significantly more likely to choose the last option, the safest one. This was true regardless of income, wealth, age, gender, entrepreneurial experience, marital status, education, household size, and expectations of how well other businesses would perform. We find that entrepreneurs are significantly more risk-averse than the general population, the authors conclude. These are just preferences on a survey, but when you track entrepreneurs' real-world behavior, it's clear that they avoid dangerous risks. Economists find that as teenagers, successful entrepreneurs were nearly three times as likely as their peers to break rules and engage in illicit activities. Yet when you take a closer look at the specific behaviors involved, the adolescents who went on to start productive companies were only taking calculated risks. When psychologists studied American twins and Swedish citizens, they found the same results. Across all three studies, the people who become successful entrepreneurs were more likely to have teenage histories of defying their parents, staying out past their curfews, skipping school, shoplifting, gambling, drinking alcohol, and smoking marijuana. They were not, however, more likely to engage in hazardous activities like driving drunk, buying illegal drugs, or stealing valuables. And that was true regardless of their parents' socioeconomic status or family income. Originals do vary in their attitudes toward risk. Some are skydiving gamblers. Others are penny-pinching germaphobes. To become original, you have to try something new, which means accepting some measure of risk. But the most successful originals are not the daredevils who leap before they look. They are the ones who reluctantly tiptoe to the edge of a cliff, calculate the rate of descent, triple-check their parachutes, and set up a safety net at the bottom, just in case. As Malcolm Gladwell wrote in The New Yorker, many entrepreneurs take plenty of risks, but those are generally the failed entrepreneurs, not the success stories. A disregard for social approval doesn't differentiate people who take original paths either. In a comprehensive analysis of 60 studies covering more than 15,000 entrepreneurs, people who had little concern for pleasing others weren't more likely to become entrepreneurs, nor did their firms perform any better. We see the same pattern in politics. When hundreds of historians, psychologists, and political scientists evaluated America's presidents, they determined that the least effective leaders were those who followed the will of the people and the precedents set by their predecessors. The greatest presidents were those who challenged the status quo and brought about sweeping changes that improved the lot of the country. But these behaviors were completely unrelated to whether they cared deeply about public approval and social harmony. Abraham Lincoln is usually regarded as the greatest of all American presidents. When experts rated the presidents on the desire to please others and avoid conflict, Lincoln scored the highest of them all. He devoted 4 hours a day to holding office hours with citizens and pardoned deserters during the Civil War. Before signing the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln agonized for 6 months over whether he should free the slaves. He questioned whether he had the constitutional authority. He worried that the decision might lose him the support of the border states, forfeit the war, and destroy the country. Originality is not a fixed trait. It is a free choice. Lincoln wasn't born with an original personality. Taking on controversy wasn't programmed into his DNA. It was an act of conscious will. As the great thinker W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "He was one of you, and yet he became Abraham Lincoln." Too often that possibility of control is missing from our work and our lives. A few years ago, Google asked a brilliant Yale professor named Amy Wisniewski to help enrich the jobs of employees in sales and administrative positions who didn't have the same perceived freedom, status, or moonshot projects as the company's engineers. I joined her and another collaborator, Justin Berg, on a trip to California, New York, Dublin, and London in search of a solution. Many employees were so committed to Google that they accepted their own jobs as defaults. Since they saw their tasks and interactions as set like plaster, they did not question whether they could adjust them. To unlock their mindsets, we partnered with Jennifer Kurkowski and Brian Well, two innovators behind Google's people analytics work. We designed a workshop introducing hundreds of employees to the notion that jobs are not static sculptures, but flexible building blocks. We gave them examples of people becoming the architects of their own jobs, customizing their tasks and relationships to better align with their interests, skills, and values, like an artistic salesperson volunteering to design a new logo, and an outgoing financial analyst communicating with clients using video chat instead of email. Then, they looked at their familiar jobs in an unfamiliar way. Vuja Day. They set out to create a new vision of their roles that was more ideal, but still realistic. Managers and co-workers rated each employee's happiness and performance before the workshop and after several weeks and months had passed. The whole experience lasted only 90 minutes, so we weren't sure that it would be enough to make a difference. But 6 weeks later, Googlers who were randomly assigned to think about their jobs as malleable showed a spike in happiness and performance. Having considered how their jobs could be modified, they had taken action to improve them. Employees in a control group who didn't attend the same workshop didn't show any changes in happiness or performance. When we added a feature to encourage employees to see both their skills and jobs as flexible, the gains lasted for at least 6 months. Instead of using only their existing talents, they took the initiative to develop new capabilities that enabled them to create an original, personalized job. As a result, they were 70% more likely than their peers to land a promotion or a transition to a coveted role. By refusing to stick with their default jobs and default skills, they became happier and more effective, and qualified themselves for roles that were a better fit. Many of their limits, they came to realize, were of their own making. Having revealed that successful originals often begin by questioning defaults and balancing risk portfolios, the rest of this audiobook is about closing the gap between insight and action. Once you have a new idea, how do you champion it effectively? As an organizational psychologist at Wharton, I spent more than a decade studying originality in a wide range of settings, from technology companies and banks to schools, hospitals, and governments. I've also sought out some of the most prominent originals of our time, and I want to share their wisdom about how we can all be more original without jeopardizing our relationships, reputations, and careers. I hope my findings will help people develop the courage and strategies to pursue originality, and give leaders the knowledge necessary to create cultures of originality in their teams and organizations. Using studies and stories spanning business, politics, sports, and entertainment, I'll look at the seeds of creative, moral, and organizational change, and the barriers that hinder progress. The first section of this audiobook focuses on managing the risks involved in generating, recognizing, and voicing original ideas. By definition, new ideas are fraught with uncertainty, and powerful evidence illuminates how we can hone our skills in separating the wheat from the chaff to avoid the risks of betting on bad ideas and passing on good ones. After you spot a promising idea, the next step is to communicate it effectively. I'll share some best practices for speaking up, shedding light on how to select the messages and audiences to get heard more and punished less. Along the way, you'll find out why the most popular television show of all time narrowly escaped the cutting room floor, why an entrepreneur pitches his startups by highlighting the reasons not to invest in them, how a CIA analyst convinced the intelligence community to stop being so secretive, and how a woman at Apple challenged Steve Jobs from three levels below and won. The second section of the audiobook deals with the choices that we make to scale originality. I'll start with the dilemma of timing. It turns out that you should be wary of being the first mover, because it's often riskier to act early than late. Unexpectedly, some of the greatest creative achievements and change initiatives in history have their roots in procrastination, and the tendency to delay and postpone can help entrepreneurs build companies that last, leaders guide transformation efforts, and innovators maintain their originality. I'll then turn to the challenges of coalition building, investigating how to grow support for an original idea and reduce the risks of rejection. The unsung hero of the women's suffrage movement will illustrate why enemies make better allies than frenemies, and shared values can divide rather than unite. A founder who hid her firm's mission from employees and a Hollywood director who shifted Disney's direction for animated films will demonstrate how to recruit collaborators by balancing idealism with pragmatism and blending the familiar with the new. The third section of the audiobook concerns unleashing and sustaining originality, both at home and in work. I'll examine how to nurture originality in children, explaining how parents, siblings, and role models shape their tendencies to rebel. You'll see why the number of bases that professional baseball players steal can be traced to their birth order. The most original comedians in America come from similar family backgrounds. The people who risked their lives to perform heroic rescues during the Holocaust received a particular kind of discipline from their parents, and the innovation and economic growth rates of entire countries can be traced to the books we read to our children. From there, I'll consider why some cultures become cults and how leaders can encourage dissenting opinions that allow originality to flourish. You'll learn from a billionaire financial wizard who fires employees for failing to criticize him, an inventor who struggled to spread his ingenuity, and an expert who helped change the norm of silence at NASA after the space shuttle Columbia exploded. I'll close with reflections on the emotions that hold us back from pursuing originality. You'll gain insight on overcoming fear and apathy from a group of 20-somethings who toppled a tyrant, and a lawyer who fought climate change by swimming the North Pole. Their examples underscore evidence that calming down isn't the best way to manage anxiety, that venting backfires when we're angry, and that pessimism is sometimes more energizing than optimism. Ultimately, the people who choose to champion originality are the ones who propel us forward. After spending years studying them and interacting with them, I am struck that their inner experiences are not any different from our own. They feel the same fear, the same doubt as the rest of us. What sets them apart is that they take action anyway. They know in their hearts that failing would yield less regret than failing to try. Chapter 2. Blind Inventors and One-Eyed Investors. The Art and Science of Recognizing Original Ideas. Creativity is allowing yourself to make mistakes. Art is knowing which ones to keep. Scott Adams. At the turn of the century, an invention took Silicon Valley by storm. Steve Jobs called it the most amazing piece of technology since the personal computer. Enamored with the prototype, Jobs offered the inventor $63 million for 10% of the company. When the inventor turned it down, Jobs did something out of character. He offered to advise the inventor for the next 6 months, for free. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos took one look at the product and immediately got involved, telling the inventor, "You have a product so revolutionary, you'll have no problem selling it." John Doerr, the legendary investor who bet successfully on Google and many other blue-chip startups, pumped $80 million into the business, predicting that it would be the fastest company ever to reach $1 billion and would become more important than the Internet. The inventor himself was described as a modern Thomas Edison. He already had a track record of remarkable breakthroughs. His portable dialysis machine had been named the medical product of the year. His portable drug infusion pump reduced the time that patients were stuck in hospitals. And his vascular stent is connected to Vice President Dick Cheney's heart. He had accumulated hundreds of patents and received America's highest honor for invention, the National Medal of Technology and Innovation, from President Bill Clinton. The inventor projected that within a year, sales of his newest product would reach 10,000 units a week. But 6 years later, they had sold only about 30,000 units in total. After more than a decade, the company still hadn't become profitable. It was supposed to transform lives and cities, but today it is used only in niche markets. That product was the Segway, the self-balancing personal transporter. Time called it one of the 10 biggest technology flops of the decade. Segway as an investment was a failure, no question about it, Doerr admitted in 2013. I made some pretty bold predictions about Segway that were wrong. Why did such savvy business minds all miss the mark? Some years earlier, two entertainers got together to create a 90-minute television special. They had no experience writing for the medium and quickly ran out of material. So they shifted their concept to a half-hour weekly show. When they submitted their script, most of the network executives didn't like it or didn't get it. One of the actors involved in the program described it as a glorious mess. After filming the pilot, it was time for an audience test. The 100 viewers who were assembled in Los Angeles to discuss the strengths and weaknesses of the show dismissed it as a dismal failure. One put it bluntly, "He's just a loser. Who'd want to watch this guy?" After about 600 additional people were shown the pilot in four different cities, the summary report concluded, "No segment of the audience was eager to watch the show again. The performance was rated weak." The pilot episode squeaked onto the airwaves, and as expected, it wasn't a hit. Between that and the negative audience tests, the show should have been toast. But one executive campaigned to have four more episodes made. They didn't go live until nearly a year after the pilot, and again, they failed to gain a devoted following. With the clock winding down, the network ordered half a season as replacement for a canceled show. But by then, one of the writers was ready to walk away. He didn't have any more ideas. It's a good thing he changed his mind. Over the next decade, the show dominated the Nielsen ratings and brought in over $1 billion in revenues. It became the most popular TV series in America, and TV Guide named it the greatest program of all time. If you've ever complained about a close talker, accused a partygoer of double-dipping a chip, uttered the disclaimer, "Not that there's anything wrong with that," or rejected someone by saying, "No soup for you," you're using phrases coined on the show. Why did network executives have so little faith in Seinfeld? When we bemoan the lack of originality in the world, we blame it on the absence of creativity. If only people could generate more novel ideas, we'd all be better off. But in reality, the biggest barrier to originality is not idea generation, it's idea selection. In one analysis, when over 200 people dreamed up more than 1,000 ideas for new ventures and products, 87% were completely unique. Our companies, communities, and countries don't necessarily suffer from a shortage of novel ideas. They're constrained by a shortage of people who excel at choosing the right novel ideas. The segue was a false positive. It was forecast as a hit, but turned out to be a miss. Seinfeld was a false negative. It was expected to fail, but ultimately flourished. This chapter is about the hurdles and best practices in idea selection. To figure out how we can make fewer bad bets, I sought out skilled forecasters who have learned to avoid the risks of false positives and false negatives. You'll meet two venture capitalists who anticipated the failure of the segue, and the NBC executive who didn't even work in comedy, but was so enthusiastic about the Seinfeld pilot that he went out on a limb to fund it. Their methods question conventional wisdom about the relative importance of intuition and analysis in assessing ideas, and about how we should weigh passion in evaluating the people behind those ideas. You'll see why it's so difficult for managers and test audiences to accurately evaluate new ideas, and how we can get better at deciding when to roll the dice. A random walk on the creative tightrope. The inventor of the segue is a technological whiz named Dean Kamen, whose closet is stocked with one outfit, a denim shirt, jeans, and work boots. When I asked venture capitalists to describe Kamen, the most common response was Batman. At 16, he took it upon himself to redesign a museum's lighting system, and only then sought the chairman's permission to implement it. In the 1970s, he invented the drug infusion pump, which was profitable enough that he bought a jet and a helicopter and built a mansion in New Hampshire, complete with a machine shop, an electronics lab, and a baseball field. In the 1980s, his portable dialysis machine was a massive success. In the 1990s, Kamen designed the iBot, a wheelchair that could climb stairs. Recognizing broader applications for the technology, he brought in a team to help create the Segway. The goal was to build a safe, fuel-efficient vehicle that would prevent pollution and help individuals navigate congested cities. Because it was small, lightweight, and balanced on its own, it would be a natural fit for mail carriers, police officers, and golfers, but also had the potential to fundamentally alter everyday transportation. The Segway was the most extraordinary technology he had ever created, and Kamen predicted that it would be to the car what the car was to the horse and buggy. But can creators ever be objective in judging their own ideas? One of my former students, Justin Berg, is now a Wunderkind professor at Stanford, who has spent years investigating this question. Berg specializes in creative forecasting, the art of predicting the success of novel ideas. In one study, he showed different groups of people videos of circus performances and asked them to make projections about how well each would do. Circus artists from Cirque du Soleil and other organizations submitted predictions about how popular their videos would be. Circus managers watched the videos and registered their predictions, too. To test the accuracy of their forecasts, Berg then measured the actual success of each performance by tracking how much general audience members liked, shared, and funded the videos. He invited over 13,000 people to rate the videos. They also had a chance to share them via Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and email, and received a 10-cent bonus that they could donate to the performers. The creators proved to be terrible at judging how their performances would do with test audiences. On average, when ranking their videos against the performances of 9 other circus artists, they put their own work 2 slots too high. The managers were more realistic. They had some distance from the performances, which put them in a more neutral position. Social scientists have long known that we tend to be overconfident when we evaluate ourselves, Here are some highlights of their findings. High school seniors. 70% report that they have above-average leadership skills, compared with 2% below average. In the ability to get along with others, 25% rate themselves in the top 1%, and 60% put themselves in the top 10%. College professors. 94% rate themselves as doing above-average work. Engineers. In two different companies, 32% and 42% rated themselves among the top 5% of performers. Entrepreneurs. When 3,000 small business owners rated the probability that different companies would succeed, on average, they rated the prospects of their own businesses as 8.1 out of 10, but gave similar enterprises odds of only 5.9 out of 10. Overconfidence may be a particularly difficult bias to overcome in the creative domain. When you're generating a new idea, by definition, it's unique, so you can ignore all the feedback you've received in the past about earlier inventions. Even if your previous ideas have bombed, this one is different. When we've developed an idea, we're typically too close to our own tastes and too far from the audience's taste to evaluate it accurately. We're giddy from the thrill of the eureka moment or the triumph of overcoming an obstacle. As Brandon Tartikoff, NBC's longtime entertainment president, frequently reminded his producers, "Nobody walks in here with what they think is a bad idea." To some degree, entrepreneurs and inventors have to be overconfident about the odds of their ideas succeeding, or they wouldn't have the motivational fuel to pursue them. But even when they do learn about their audience's preferences, it's too easy for them to fall victim to what psychologists call confirmation bias. They focus on the strengths of their ideas while ignoring or discounting their limitations. After spending his career studying creative productivity, psychologist Dean Simonton has found that even geniuses have trouble recognizing when they have a hit on their hands. In music, Beethoven was known as a perceptive self-critic, yet as Simonton observes, Beethoven's own favorites among his symphonies, sonatas, and quartets are not those most frequently performed and recorded by posterity. In one analysis, psychologist Aaron Cosbelt pored over letters in which Beethoven evaluated 70 of his compositions, comparing those appraisals to expert judgments of Beethoven's works. In that set of 70, Beethoven committed 15 false positives, expecting pieces to be major that turned out to be minor, and only 8 false negatives, criticizing pieces that ended up becoming highly valued. This 33% error rate occurred despite the fact that Beethoven made many of his assessments after receiving audience feedback. If creators knew when they were on their way to fashioning a masterpiece, their work would progress only forward. They would halt their idea generation efforts as they struck gold. But time and again, Simonton finds that they backtrack, returning to iterations that they had earlier discarded as inadequate. In Beethoven's most celebrated work, the Fifth Symphony, he scrapped the conclusion of the first movement because it felt too short, only to come back to it later. Had Beethoven been able to distinguish an extraordinary from an ordinary work, he would have accepted his composition immediately as a hit. When Picasso was painting his famous Guernica in protest of fascism, he produced 79 different drawings. Many of the images in the painting were based on his early sketches, not the later variations. The subsequent sketches proved to constitute blind alleys, in which the artist did not know in advance that he was taking the wrong track, Simonton explains. If Picasso could judge his creations as he produced them, he would get consistently warmer and use the later drawings. But in reality, it was just as common that he got colder. Kissing frogs. If originals aren't reliable judges of the quality of their ideas, how do they maximize their odds of creating a masterpiece? They come up with a large number of ideas. Simonton finds that on average, creative geniuses weren't qualitatively better in their fields than their peers. They simply produced a greater volume of work, which gave them more variation and a higher chance of originality. The odds of producing an influential or successful idea, Simonton notes, are a positive function of the total number of ideas generated. Consider Shakespeare. We're most familiar with a small number of his classics, forgetting that in the span of two decades, he produced 37 plays and 154 sonnets. Simonton tracked the popularity of Shakespeare's plays, measuring how often they're performed and how widely they're praised by experts and critics. In the same five-year window that Shakespeare produced three of his five most popular works, Macbeth, King Lear, and Othello, he also churned out the comparatively average Timon of Athens and All's Well That Ends Well, both of which rank among the worst of his plays, and have been consistently slammed for unpolished prose and incomplete plot and character development. In every field, even the most eminent creators typically produce a large quantity of work that's technically sound but considered unremarkable by experts and audiences. When the London Philharmonic Orchestra chose the 50 greatest pieces of classical music, the list included 6 pieces by Mozart, 5 by Beethoven, and 3 by Bach. To generate a handful of masterworks, Mozart composed more than 600 pieces before his death at 35. Beethoven produced 650 in his lifetime, and Bach wrote over 1,000. In a study of over 15,000 classical music compositions, the more pieces a composer produced in a given five-year window, the greater the spike in the odds of a hit. Picasso's oeuvre includes more than 1,800 paintings, 1,200 sculptures, 2,800 ceramics, and 12,000 drawings, not to mention prints, rugs, and tapestries, only a fraction of which have garnered acclaim. In poetry, when we recite Maya Angelou's classic poem, Still I Rise, we tend to forget that she wrote 165 others. We remember her moving memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and pay less attention to her other 6 autobiographies. In science, Einstein wrote papers on general and special relativity that transformed physics, but many of his 248 publications had minimal impact. If you want to be original, the most important possible thing you could do, says Ira Glass, the producer of This American Life and the podcast Serial, is do a lot of work. Do a huge volume of work. Across fields, Simonton reports that the most prolific people not only have the highest originality, they also generate their most original output during the periods in which they produce the largest volume. This is one reason why men seem to have more influential creative accomplishments than women. Historically, the doors to many creative careers were closed to women. Those who managed to get their feet in the door were often full-time caregivers for children. As a result, men simply produced more output than women, giving them a higher chance of originality. With greater equality of opportunity today, these gender differences in creative output ought to disappear and may even reverse. Berg finds that on average, women make better creative forecasts than men. They're more open to novel ideas, which leaves them less prone to false negatives. Between the ages of 30 and 35, Edison pioneered the light bulb, the phonograph, and the carbon telephone. But during that period, he filed well over 100 patents for other inventions, as diverse as stencil pens, a fruit preservation technique, and a way of using magnets to mine iron ore, and designed a creepy talking doll. Those periods in which the most minor products appear tend to be the same periods in which the most major works appear, Symington notes. Edison's 1,093 patents notwithstanding, the number of truly superlative creative achievements can probably be counted on the fingers of one hand. It's widely assumed that there's a trade-off between quantity and quality. If you want to do better work, you have to do less of it. But this turns out to be false. In fact, when it comes to idea generation, quantity is the most predictable path to quality. Original thinkers, Stanford professor Robert Sutton notes, will come up with many ideas that are strange mutations, dead ends, and utter failures. The cost is worthwhile, because they also generate a larger pool of ideas, especially novel ideas. Many people fail to achieve originality because they generate a few ideas and then obsess about refining them to perfection. At Upworthy, the company that makes good content go viral, two different staff members wrote headlines for a video of monkeys reacting to receiving cucumbers or grapes as rewards. 8,000 people watched it when the headline was, "Remember Planet of the Apes? It's closer to reality than you think." A different headline led to 59 times more views, enticing nearly 500,000 people to watch the same video. Two monkeys were paid unequally. See what happens next. Upworthy's rule is that you need to generate at least 25 headline ideas to strike gold. Backtracking studies show that wizards do sometimes come up with novel ideas early in the creative process. But for the rest of us, our first ideas are often the most conventional, the closest to the default that already exists. It's only after we've ruled out the obvious that we have the greatest freedom to consider the more remote possibilities. Once you start getting desperate, you start thinking outside the box, the Upworthy team writes. Number 24 will suck. Then number 25 will be a gift from the headline gods and will make you a legend. While working on the Segway, Dean Kamen was aware of the blind variations that mark the creative process. With more than 440 patents to his name, he had plenty of misses as well as hits. "You gotta kiss a lot of frogs," he often told his team, "before you find a prince." In fact, frog kissing was one of his mantras. He encouraged his engineers to try out many variations to increase their chances of stumbling on the right one. But he settled on the Segway before considering other ideas for solving transportation problems, losing sight of the fact that inventors will necessarily struggle mightily in gauging whether their creations are ultimately frogs or princes. The best way to get better at judging our ideas is to gather feedback. Put a lot of ideas out there and see which ones are praised and adopted by your target audience. After spending decades creating comedy, The Daily Show co-creator Liz Winstead still doesn't know what will make people laugh. She recalls that she was desperately trying to figure out jokes, writing them out, and trying them on stage. Some of them sizzled, others popped. Now, with social media, she has a more rapid feedback mechanism. When she thinks of a joke, she tweets it. When she comes up with a longer bit, she posts it on Facebook. When she receives at least 25 retweets in less than a minute, or a high number of Facebook shares, she saves the idea. At the end of the day, she develops the material that proved most popular with her audience. "Twitter and Facebook have tremendously helped me decide what people care about," Winstead explains. When developing the Segway, Dean Kamen didn't open the door to this kind of feedback. Concerned that someone would steal his idea, or that the fundamental concept would become public too soon, he maintained strict secrecy rules. Many of his own employees weren't allowed access to the area where the Segway was being developed. Only an elite group of potential investors had a chance to try it out. When building the Segway, his team generated a wide number of ideas, but didn't have enough critical input from customers to make the right choices for the final product. The device went through 3 or 4 iterations before a customer ever saw it. The lesson here isn't to ask customers what they want. As the famous line often attributed to Henry Ford goes, if I had asked my customers what they wanted, they would have said, a faster horse. Instead, creators ought to build a car and see if customers will drive it. That means identifying a potential need, designing what the Lean Startup author Eric Ries calls a minimum viable product, testing different versions, and gathering feedback. Conviction in our ideas is dangerous, not only because it leaves us vulnerable to false positives, but also because it stops us from generating the requisite variety to reach our creative potential. But Kamen and his team weren't the only ones who were too bullish on the Segway. Where did virtuosos like Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos, and John Doerr misstep in their judgments about the device? To find out, let's first take a look at why many executives and test audiences fail to see the potential in Seinfeld. Prisoners of prototypes and parochial preferences. When the first Seinfeld script was submitted, executives didn't know what to do with it. It was totally unconventional, NBC executive Warren Littlefield said. It didn't sound like anything else on television. There was no historical precedent. In Justin Berg's study of circus performances, although circus managers made more accurate forecasts than artists, they still weren't very good, especially regarding the most novel acts. Managers tend to be too risk-averse. They focus on the costs of investing in bad ideas rather than the benefits of piloting good ones, which leads them to commit a large number of false negatives. The author of the initial report on the Seinfeld pilot felt it was on the border between weak and moderate. He was leaning toward moderate, but his boss overruled him and rated it weak. These types of false negatives are common in the entertainment industry. Studio executives passed on hits ranging from Star Wars to E.T. to Pulp Fiction. In publishing, managers rejected The Chronicles of Narnia, The Diary of Anne Frank, Gone with the Wind, Lord of the Flies, and Harry Potter. As of 2015, J.K. Rowling's books alone had brought in over $25 billion and sold more copies than any book series ever. The annals of corporate innovation are filled with tales of managers ordering employees to stop working on projects that turned out to be big hits. From Nietzsche's invention of LED lighting, to Pontiac's Fiero car, to HP's electrostatic displays. The Xbox was almost buried at Microsoft. The laser printer was nearly canceled at Xerox for being expensive and impractical. In the face of uncertainty, our first instinct is often to reject novelty, looking for reasons why unfamiliar concepts might fail. When managers vet novel ideas, they're in an evaluative mindset. To protect themselves against the risks of a bad bet, they compare the new notion on the table to templates of ideas that have succeeded in the past. When publishing executives passed on Harry Potter, they said it was too long for a children's book. When Brandon Tartikoff saw the Seinfeld pilot, he felt it was too Jewish and too New York to appeal to a wide audience. Rice professor Eric Dane finds that the more expertise and experience people gain, the more entrenched they become in a particular way of viewing the world. He points to studies showing that expert bridge players struggled more than novices to adapt when the rules were changed, and that expert accountants were worse than novices at applying a new tax law. As we gain knowledge about a domain, we become prisoners of our prototypes. In principle, audiences should be more open to novelty than managers. They don't have the blinders associated with expertise, and they have little to lose by considering a fresh format and expressing enthusiasm for an unusual idea. In practice, though, Justin Berg finds that test audiences are no better than managers at predicting the success of new ideas. Focus groups are effectively set up to make the same mistakes as managers. When you watch a show in your living room, you get absorbed in the plot. If you find yourself laughing throughout, you'll end up pronouncing it funny. When you watch it in a focus group, however, you don't engage with the program in the same way. You're conscious of the fact that you're there to evaluate it, not experience it, so you're judging it from the start. Because you're trying to figure out whether people will watch it, you naturally assess it against established ideas of how such a show ought to work. When test audiences viewed the Seinfeld pilot, they thought it lacked the community of Cheers, the family dynamics of The Cosby Show, and the relatability of Alf. It was all too easy to find flaws in a show that was ostensibly about nothing. The truth is, most pilots don't test well, Warren Littlefield observes, because audiences do not respond well to things that are new or different. Audiences don't have enough experience. They simply haven't seen a lot of the novel ideas that landed on the cutting room floor. The Seinfeld testing should put an end to all conversations about testing, ever. Please don't tell me my show is going to come down to 20 people in Sherman Oaks, comedian Paul Reiser says. I've never been to any testing that's any good. So neither test audiences nor managers are ideal judges of creative ideas. They're too prone to false negatives. They focus too much on reasons to reject an idea and stick too closely to existing prototypes. And we've seen that creators struggle as well, because they're too positive about their own ideas. But there is one group of forecasters that does come close to attaining mastery. Fellow creators evaluating one another's ideas. In Berg's study of circus acts, the most accurate predictors of whether a video would get liked, shared, and funded were peers evaluating one another. When artists assessed one another's performances, they were about twice as accurate as managers and test audiences in predicting how often the videos would be shared. Compared to creators, managers and test audiences were 56% and 55% more prone to major false negatives, undervaluing a strong, novel performance by 5 ranks or more in the set of 10 they viewed. We often speak of the wisdom of crowds, but we need to be careful about which crowds we're considering. On average, the combined forecasts of all 120 circus managers were no better than a typical single creator's predictions. Managers and test audiences tended to fixate on a particular category of favored acts and reject the rest. Creators were more open to different kinds of performances. They saw potential in peers who did aerial and ground acrobatics, but also in skilled jugglers and mimes. One category of circus acts was universally disliked by managers, test audiences, and creators. Clowns. It's not a coincidence that one Seinfeld episode revolves around clowns striking fear into the hearts of adults as well as children. Instead of attempting to assess our own originality or seeking feedback from managers, we ought to turn more often to our colleagues. They lack the risk aversion of managers and test audiences. They're open to seeing the potential in unusual possibilities, which guards against false negatives. At the same time, they have no particular investment in our ideas, which gives them enough distance to offer an honest appraisal and protects against false positives. This evidence helps to explain why many performers enjoy the approval of audiences but covet the admiration of their peers. Comedians often say that the highest badge of honor is to make a fellow comic laugh. Magicians like fooling audiences, but live to baffle their brethren. The usual explanation for this preference is status driving. We crave acceptance by our peer group, those similar to us. But Berg's research suggests that we're also drawn to peer evaluations because they provide the most reliable judgments. When we evaluate new ideas, we can become better at avoiding false negatives by thinking more like creators. In a series of experiments, Berg asked over 1,000 adults to make forecasts about the success of novel products in the marketplace. Some were ideas that might be useful: a 3D image projector, a flooring system that simulates natural ground, and an automatic bed maker. Others were less practical, like an electrified tablecloth to prevent ants from ruining a picnic. The rest were conventional ideas that varied in usefulness, from a portable container for steaming food in a microwave to a hands-free system for carrying towels. Berg wanted to boost the chances that people would correctly rank a novel, useful idea first, as opposed to favoring conventional ideas. He randomly assigned half of the participants to think like managers by spending 6 minutes making a list of 3 criteria for evaluating the success of new products. This group then made the right bet on a novel, useful idea 51% of the time. But the other group of participants was much more accurate, choosing the most promising new idea over 77% of the time. All it took was having them spend their initial 6 minutes a little differently. Instead of adopting a managerial mindset for evaluating ideas, they got into a creative mindset by generating ideas themselves. Just spending 6 minutes developing original ideas made them more open to novelty, improving their ability to see the potential in something unusual. From these findings, you might think that we can improve idea selection simply by making sure that managers have some experience as creators. But in Berg's circus data, former artists who become managers aren't significantly better in their evaluations than regular managers. Pure artists are still the best forecasters. Once you take on a managerial role, it's hard to avoid letting an evaluative mindset creep in to cause false negatives. Berg demonstrated this in an experiment by asking people to generate product ideas and then come up with a list of evaluation criteria, and subsequently measured the success of the ideas with an actual audience. Thinking like creators and then donning the manager hat dropped their forecasting accuracy to 41%. When Berg reversed the order so that they made a list of evaluation criteria first and then generated ideas, their accuracy climbed to 65%. If we want to increase our odds of betting on the best original ideas, we have to generate our own ideas immediately before we screen other suggestions. And this, it turns out, helps to explain why Seinfeld saw the light of day. The double-edged sword of experience. When the test audience panned the Seinfeld pilot, it was a dagger to the heart, Warren Littlefield reflected. We were afraid to go forward with something that was so strongly rejected by research. Although the ideal people to give the show a chance might have been fellow comedy writers, there weren't any pure writers in positions of power. But Rick Ludwin, the man who ultimately made the show happen, was the next best thing. Ludwin would later make his mark by standing up for Jay Leno, going to bat for Conan O'Brien, and fighting to renew a show that didn't have a big enough following early on, The Office. But his greatest contribution to television was commissioning the pilot for Seinfeld. At that point in his career, Rick Ludwin didn't even work in the comedy department, but handled variety and specials. When the Seinfeld pilot didn't take off, he went on a mission to give it another chance. He found a few hours in his lineup that hadn't been assigned, divided them into half-hour slots, and took the money from his specials budget to fund more episodes. As far as we know, that was the smallest order of episodes ever for a television show, Ludwin says. Jerry Seinfeld would go on to remark that an order of 6 episodes is like a slap in the face. NBC ordered just 4. If you're going to make connections which are innovative, Steve Jobs said back in 1982, you have to not have the same bag of experience as everyone else does. Working outside the sitcom department may have been Rick Ludwin's greatest advantage. Larry David and Jerry had never written a sitcom, and my department had never developed one, Ludwin recalls. We were a good match, because we didn't know what rules we weren't supposed to break. His outsider status gave him enough detachment from the standard format of sitcoms to consider something different. Most sitcoms shot a few continuous scenes in a tidy 22-minute episode. Seinfeld often left conflicts unresolved and had as many as 20 different scenes packed in. This was bothersome if you lived exclusively in the sitcom world, but perfectly comfortable for a guy who used a different arrangement in every special. At the same time, Ludwin did have the requisite experience in creating comedy. While working as a producer in the 1970s, he wrote jokes and sold them to Bob Hope, and then produced segments for a daytime variety show that featured comedy sketches. Being around comedy writers is like going to a baseball fantasy camp. You think you're really good until you get up to bat, he reminisces. Not only can't you hit the ball, you can't even see the ball. I knew I was not in their league, but I at least spoke the same language. It is when people have moderate expertise in a particular domain that they're the most open to radically creative ideas. Ludwin's deep experience in comedy gave him the necessary expertise in humor. His broad experience outside sitcoms prevented him from getting blinded to alternative ways of delivering it. Instead of narrowly scrutinizing what made a sitcom a hit, he had cast a wider net in studying what made comedy in general succeed. You never know where the next big hit is coming from. It can come from left field. If you think, that can't possibly work, because that producer doesn't have enough experience, or no idea like that has ever worked. If you have those kinds of roadblocks in your head, you're going to miss something. One of the best things that I had going for me was the fact that I had never developed a primetime situation comedy, but I was accustomed to offbeat, off-kilter ideas. I could see what worked and what didn't work. The time I spent reading Saturday Night Live scripts made me more open to the offbeat storylines that are now legendary on Seinfeld. This unique combination of broad and deep experience is critical for creativity. In a recent study comparing every Nobel Prize-winning scientist from 1901 to 2005 with typical scientists of the same era, both groups attained deep expertise in their respective fields of study. But the Nobel Prize winners were dramatically more likely to be involved in the arts than less accomplished scientists. Here's what a team of 15 researchers at Michigan State University found about engagement in the arts among Nobel Prize winners relative to ordinary scientists. Artistic hobby, music, playing an instrument, composing, conducting. Odds for Nobel Prize winners relative to typical scientists, 2 times greater. Arts, drawing, painting, printmaking, sculpting, 7 times greater. Crafts, woodworking, mechanics, electronics, glassblowing, 7.5 times greater. Writing, poetry, plays, novels, short stories, essays, popular books, 12 times greater. Performing, amateur actor, dancer, magician, 22 times greater. A representative study of thousands of Americans showed similar results for entrepreneurs and inventors. People who started businesses and contributed to patent applications were more likely than their peers to have leisure time hobbies that involved drawing, painting, architecture, sculpture, and literature. Interest in the arts among entrepreneurs, inventors, and eminent scientists obviously reflects their curiosity and aptitude. People who are open to new ways of looking at science and business also tend to be fascinated by the expression of ideas and emotions through images, sounds, and words. The personality trait most associated with an interest in the arts is called openness. The tendency to seek out novelty and variety in intellectual, aesthetic, and emotional pursuits. When psychologist Robert McCrae analyzed 4 dozen questions across 51 different cultures, one of the best indicators of openness was agreeing with the statement, "Sometimes when I am reading poetry or looking at a work of art, I feel a chill or wave of excitement." Around the world, from the U.S. to Japan and Brazil to Norway, the most open-minded people experience aesthetic chills, shivers and goosebumps when appreciating art or hearing beautiful music. I acquired